You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court will most likely be filled by the next president. We'll talk to a political scientist about how this open seat is affecting the November election.
First, at the start of his presidency, President Obama pledged to shut down the detention facility at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay. The facility still exists. As of yesterday, has 61 detainees still there. As the race for the president continues, the future of the facility has yet to be seen. Last week, Republican nominee Donald Trump spoke to a Miami Herald reporter about keeping the facility open and even trying Americans there.
As far as Guantanamo is concerned, I want to make sure, 100% sure, that if we're going to release people, number one, they're going to be people that can be released, and it's going to be safe to release them. And we have plenty of bad ones out there, and I would use it for that.
Would you try to get the military commissions, the trial court there, to try U.S. citizens?
Well, I know that they want to try them in our regular court systems, and I don't like that at all. I would say they could be tried there. I would be fine.
In serving as Secretary of State under the Obama administration, Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton has supported moves to close the facility, though she hasn't spoken about the issue much since being on the campaign trail.
Joining us now to tell us more about the future of the detention facility is Michael Newton. He's a professor at Vanderbilt Law School. He focuses on things like terrorism, accountability, transnational justice, and conduct of hostilities issues. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. It's good to be here.
Before we get to a possible Trump or Clinton presidency, let's talk about the Obama presidency and Guantanamo. One of his opening agenda items was closing it. It is not closed. Why has it been so hard to close the facility at Guantanamo?
Well, it's enormously complex in terms of the legal issues, and I know I sound like a law professor. During the latter part of the Bush second term, there was a huge effort to move out and transfer detainees. At one time, there were close to 800 detainees at Guantanamo. So what you've seen is an acceleration of that. You can't close it until you get to zero, in essence, because of one statutory constraint that prohibits transfer of detainees to U.S. soil. So until you solve that problem, you can't really close it, unless you're just willing to open the floodgates and let them all out. And that would include people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the planner of 9/11, and many other people who have been determined to represent severe continuing security threats. So that's the challenge.
As you mentioned, hundreds of people are now no longer in Guantanamo. Just yesterday we saw the news, 15 will be sent to the United Arab Emirates. But as we get down to this last five dozen or so, is the fact that they're still there, does that mean they're the ones that a solution is, under present American law and present international conditions, pretty much impossible to move?
Not impossible, just extremely difficult. The number that I've seen, and it fluctuates or it can fluctuate based on new security reviews, is that about 34 have been determined to be ineligible for release on law of war grounds, that they represent a continuing threat. And that, of course, is an issue that is irrespective of party or irrespective of president, right? The president swears to support and defend the Constitution and protect the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So that core group of real threats to America, it's pretty hard to see any president saying, oh, no big deal, just, you know, go do whatever you're going to do and we'll be fine with that. Now, what happens to that smaller group is a matter of great controversy, whether they're prosecuted in a number of other forums or prosecuted in other countries or held indefinitely under the authority of the laws of war. Those are all very complex questions that we have to work out and work out in conjunction with our allies.
Talking to Michael Newton from the Vanderbilt Law School, looking at the future of the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay and the two most likely next presidents of the United States. And Mike, let's get to them now. Donald Trump, as we just heard, said he'd be fine, keeping Guantanamo open. He said he wants to put lots more, the phrase is bad dudes there. And in that bit, we heard that he would be open to American citizens being tried at the Guantanamo facility in military tribunals. How does that fit into current American law and practice?
Well, the easy answer, the second and first, of course, with respect to American citizens, the Military Commissions Act prohibits trials of American citizens in the military commissions. Now, that could be changed, theoretically. American citizens, and there's a whole prior wave of jurisprudence that says American citizens have a baseline set of constitutional rights that are best protected in Article 3 courts. In other words, normal federal criminal courts. So hey, that would require statutory change. But underlying the idea of keeping Guantanamo open is another idea that hasn't really been talked about much. For people who propose closure, the question is, what do you propose instead of Guantanamo, right? So there's a moral hazard that says, we're not going to capture anybody, we're just going to kill them. And that's a morally difficult place to go. On the other hand, where there are known threats, you say, you know, as General Petraeus used to say, you can't kill or capture your way out of this. You've got to have a long-term strategy for minimizing and eliminating the terrorist threat. And so, you know, addressing the core problem at Guantanamo is a concrete part of that strategy. And I'll say, reiterate again, it's got to be done in conjunction with our allies, because there's a great deal of legal uncertainty here.
Looking at our allies and other countries around the world, a lot of people have pointed toward Guantanamo as a moral difficulty, a black eye for the United States and the international community. Is that symbolic part of it, an important part of the story?
Well, there's no doubt that in the early days, Guantanamo both stained our reputation dramatically, but also strained our alliances, strained our relationships. People who are on the inside often squirm under that because they'll say, well, wait a minute. You know, we did everything we could do to do it right. We just did it hastily and made some mistakes. And I could catalog those mistakes if you're interested. But in large sense, that's ancient history. I mean, today, Guantanamo, the facility itself, is built to the standards of the most top-of-the-line federal penitentiaries. It's one of the best, most advanced detention systems in the world. The International Committee of the Red Cross is there and has been there from very early on. But the permanent legacy of the place is unmistakably tarred. It's sort of a non-biodegradable symbol of U.S. malfeasance in the early days of the war. But, you know, that's a long time ago.
Does it matter if we come up with a new facility not in the 50 states proper, you know, somewhere else in an American possession in the world where similar rules apply as they do at Guantanamo? And it's the same thing, it just doesn't have the name Guantanamo attached to it anymore?
Yeah, not really. I mean, the real fear among human rights advocates is that the law here, which is so unsettled, remember, in an armed conflict, in a time of war, under the laws of war, you're absolutely entitled, and it's the responsible thing to do when you capture people, to hold them until the end of hostilities. That's just well-settled law. Here we're in a state of a very different kind of armed conflict, and I use the term permawar. So you can't just, under human rights law, say it doesn't matter where you're held, we're just going to keep holding you as long as we want to hold you, as long as it's convenient. You've got to solve the core underlying problem. And there's still disputes among the allies about the precise legal basis. Is it pure human rights law? If so, that drives you down one complex set of analysis. Is it just law of war? So in a sense, it doesn't matter. I do think it would be helpful to shift out of Guantanamo just for symbolic reasons. But if all we're doing is symbolism, we're not really solving the core underlying problem.
Is there precedent out there that helps us think about this problem? As you say, this isn't a war as we think of it, where one side surrenders, the war is over, now we deal with those people we still have in custody. This is a sort of hostility that could be going for our lifetimes, really.
Well, that's right. And in that sense, it really doesn't do much good to outsource the problem. You know, there are basically three dimensions of law here that are working and kind of interlocked at the same time, which is why this is such a complex set of problems. One is the basic authority to detain people, as opposed to the right under the laws of war to conduct hostilities. And if you're purely in that domain, there's a clear-cut set of answers. You know, for the public who doesn't understand this, that would mean that they would simply be labeled prisoners of war, and therefore there's a whole very straight black-letter body of law that says what do prisoners of war get. Well, these people don't meet those definitions, but neither are they pure civilians, to which human rights law applies in its purest sense. They are in the middle ground, and I do think we need some new law here. Now, in the context of actual operations in Afghanistan, for example, we have reached some pretty concrete developments. What hasn't happened is that those developments from the battlefield have transferred back to Guantanamo in terms of practices.
You said we need new law here. Who would that come from? Is it the international community? Is it Congress? Who needs to be generating new law on these kinds of, not civilians, not combatants, but whatever we have there?
Right. Well, there's several different pieces. One are clear statutory changes. You know, for example, as I said, if a future president wished to try American citizens in the military commissions, that would require statutory change. If there was any movement which would generate some cost savings towards moving people back into the United States. That would require a statutory change. And a lot of people point to the example in World War II. You know, we did have German prisoners of war on American soil, just near to Vanderbilt, right here in Tennessee. And they say, well, see, it's feasible, it's possible. But remember, this is a bipartisan issue. I don't know of any senator who stood up and demanded that we close Guantanamo and offered the prison, the federal prison, in his or her backyard as the appropriate holding place. DOD has said that if they transfer detainees back to the United States, they want a centralized place. So there's statutory changes. On the international law side, what you have is a sort of a conflicting welter of treaties. The law of war right to hold people is one piece of that. But then when you decide to transfer them, there are other pieces of treaty law. So the Torture Convention, for example, prohibits the United States or any other country from transferring someone to a place where we know they'll be subjected to torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. So, you know, we have to work through those things with diplomatic assurances and with agreements, and they're very complex agreements. So in a way, what we're really doing is outsourcing the responsibility to some other country, whether it's UAE or Ghana or any other, lots of places. We've transferred people to over 30 countries in the world now.
We're talking to Mike Newton, professor at Vanderbilt Law School, looking at the future of Guantanamo Bay as the race for president continues.
And we want to hear from you on this. Do you think that the 15 detainees who were transferred out of the facility yesterday should have been released? And what did you think of Donald Trump saying that he would be fine with American citizens being tried before a military tribunal at Guantanamo Bay? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And what do you think of Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton's stance on the detention facility? Call 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up that conversation, look at what Hillary Clinton has said about Guantanamo, coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Michael Newton, professor at Vanderbilt Law School, about the future of Guantanamo Bay under a potential President Trump or President Clinton.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. Do you think the president should continue to try to shut down the facility at the tail end of his presidency? Have you changed your views on whether or not the facility should be shut down, maybe over the last few years? And what do you think about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton's stance on Guantanamo? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mike, we talked a little bit about what Donald Trump has had to say. Now, Hillary Clinton was part of the Obama administration, then supported the idea of closing Guantanamo. Has not been front and center, people have been saying, on the campaign trail, though. What do you think, looking at what Hillary Clinton has said and done, Guantanamo might look like under a Hillary Clinton presidency?
Well, I've had friends who ask me, as soon as each transfer is announced, they excitedly call me and they say, see, we're getting closer to closing Guantanamo. And for me, until you solve the core legal issues underlying that, there's no real meaningful movement towards closing. And that core issue is, what do you do with the hardcore group, roughly 34 to 35, that you simply cannot release under any conceivable context? You can't get sufficient security guarantees. You can't either that, or you can't get sufficient humane treatment guarantees. It's hard to see a President Clinton who would simply say, no problem, those 34, you know, current recidivism rates estimate between 20 and 30%. So let's assume five of those go back to the hostilities. Well, those are really, really major threats to the United States. It's hard to see a President Clinton saying that and then in the next breath saying, but if they do bad things, we could authorize drone strikes or special operations forces. The whole point is that you have them in custody. And the question then is, what do you do with them? That's what we have to work out with our allies and with the Congress.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Steve is on the line in Wausau. Steve, hi.
Hi there. I was, from memory, there was a Supreme Court decision, wasn't there, back in the 40s, about the military can't try civilians in a military commission? And as a second point, could the professor discuss the difference in international law between a uniformed and a non-uniformed opponent? Thank you. I'll listen off the air.
Steve, thanks for the call. A couple of big questions there. First, he says, is there precedent looking back to the 40s, I assume World War II era, from the Supreme Court on these issues, Mike?
Well, there is, and that's one of the things people go back to. Trials in the Justice Department under military commissions, one of whom was an American citizen, and the Supreme Court upheld that. The challenge being, in this context, that the Military Commissions Act prohibits exactly that. It says only non-American citizens as a statutory matter. But the other thing that's different is the nature of the conflict. World War II is fairly straightforward. You have an international armed conflict between two states, and so you had personnel on behalf of the Germans in civilian clothes, and it was easy to lump them under other categories of international law because they certainly didn't get prisoner of war status, which every other captured German in uniform did. This is a different kind of conflict, which means there's a wholly different applicable body of law, and that makes it a lot more complicated.
Right, and then his other question about combatant in a uniform versus combatant not in a uniform in the war, say, in Afghanistan. It wasn't the Afghani army the United States was at war with, but it was an organized military effort that was resisting the United States there. How are those combatants, but not state combatants, treated under international law?
The technical legal term here, just not to sound too much like a law professor, but there's no such thing as a combatant in a non-international armed conflict. In other words, combatant, although we use it in the media, we use it around our dinner tables, is a legally loaded term. And when you say somebody is a combatant, what you're really saying is that they have met the requirements under international law and are fighting in a conflict involving two states. So the legal thing that goes with that is the right to conduct hostilities. And therefore, whatever you've done that's in compliance with the laws of war is not, by definition, criminal. So let's put that in layman speak. What it means is that a terrorist who attacks the Pentagon, which otherwise would have been a lawful target in the law of war, didn't do anything wrong, is entitled to combatant's privilege. So the point is, combatant is a very technical legal term reserved exclusively for conflicts between states. And to see the symmetry here, because these people are not combatants in the legal sense, when we capture them, by definition, they're not prisoners of war. There's a boatload of other terms. There are unlawful belligerents, unlawful participants. Civilians taking direct part in hostilities is the phrase from the Geneva Convention Protocols of 1977. There's a whole raft of other terms, but combatant or unlawful combatant is not one. If you're a combatant, by definition, you're a lawful combatant because it's a legally significant term.
Steve, thanks for bringing those issues up at 800-642-1234. As we talk about the future of Guantanamo under the next president, whoever that might be, you can join in, 800-642-1234. Michael Newton is our guest from Vanderbilt Law School. Well, it seems like the conflicts of today and probably tomorrow are going to be more like what we're talking about, the United States versus a militia in Afghanistan, the United States versus a group like ISIS or its successors. Why is it taking us so long to get the legal fine points ironed out here since we've been at this for, 15 years or so?
Good question. Keep saying that because I keep saying the exact same thing. You know, we're still, in some ways, we've made some advances, particularly in Afghanistan, in conjunction with our allies. So, for example, the Copenhagen Declaration and the Copenhagen Principles we've worked out with our allies in the context of NATO operations in Afghanistan. But that's not a long-term fix when we're talking about transnational terrorism, where we're able to use drone strikes in diverse places like the Philippines or Indonesia or Mali or Bangladesh or wherever else. So I think there's really two steps here. One is to really come to grips with the core underlying international law problems. And to be clear, they are difficult problems. We're not even engaging on those issues. And the second, this is just my opinion, is I really do think that the authorization for the use of military force, which Congress passed right after 9/11, really does need to be updated to reflect a new kind of enemy, a new national threat. To me, it's a long statutory stretch to keep twisting that old piece of statutory authority, which was designed for the 9/11 attacks and designed against al-Qaeda and associated forces. The more time that goes by, the more tenuous that connection. And I do think it's time for us to, with our allies, get on more firm statutory ground as well.
Time for one more quick call with Gil on the line in Madison. Gil, hi.
Hi. I had a quick question about a particular detainee, because I've read this book called Guantanamo Diary, whether Mohamedou Ould Slahi has been released or is among those who may be released soon.
Gil, thanks for the call. Mike, I haven't been tracking the particular detainees that closely. Have you?
Not that particular detainee. There's a lot of books out there written by former detainees or by counsel who have consulted with them about things that did happen at Guantanamo. The caution I would have would be to look at the dates and the timing. Right in the aftermath of 9/11, there were some things down there that were questionable because the applicable law, Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, on its face absolutely prohibits torture or, by extension, cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, which is a very broad category of treatment. What's not really talked about, publicly anyway, is the number of people, particularly servicemen, who have been prosecuted or disciplined for violating those rules. But a lot of that is in sort of modern parlance, ancient history. And that's one thing I credit President Obama with, is the clear executive order, and Congress responded with statutory changes in the Detainee Treatment Act. That stuff, misconduct at Guantanamo, hasn't happened for a very long time. That's a big part of the problem, is that, you know, as General Petraeus would say, it's non-biodegradable. The stain of Guantanamo, the memory of Guantanamo, is forever etched both in the American consciousness and in the larger consciousness. So in some sense, there's a very real diminishing return to keeping people there. The effort to transfer them, and in that sense, is absolutely appropriate, but you still have to solve the underlying problem. What do you do with the 35 or so who are hardcore security risks that you simply cannot endanger the American lives and property by sending them back into the world?
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No, appreciate your time.
That's Michael Newton. He's a professor at Vanderbilt Law School. He joined us to talk about the future of the detention center at Guantanamo Bay under the next president. You can still share your thoughts. Are you hoping to see Guantanamo Bay's detention center closed, maybe still under an Obama presidency or under the next president, whoever that might be? Let us know your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.